Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this October the 6th on the West Coast, now October the 7th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world. We got a great show for you tonight, and we're going to go right into the issue of tonight's guest. Jeff Berlin is a legend of the electric bass. Simply put, he is considered by many to be the finest electric bass player in the world. Noted for his fluid lyrical playing, he is also a pioneer of slap bass when he brought this percussive style bass playing in 1979 to a new audience on the tune called 5G. Jeff also pioneered two-handed tapping when he performed this style on the tune Motherlode from his 1985 release of his first solo album called Champion. Jeff is known as a major innovator throughout his incisive playing through recordings and performances for the last 30 years. Jaco Pastorius regarded Jeff as a better soloist than he was. Geddy Lee referred to him as the greatest bass player on the planet. Marcus Miller told people that he wanted to be the Black Jeff Berlin. The founder of the Player School of Music in Clearwater, Florida, Jeff has also been at the front of music education for almost 30 years. His column in Guitar Player and Bass Player magazines were the most read columns due to their controversial content, emphasizing music education over more popular learning concepts aimed at technique-type instruction. His numerous recording credits include 6 highly acclaimed solo records, Champion, Pump It, Taking Notes, In Harmony's Way, Lumpy Jazz, and Aneurysms. Jeff tours with his band that has features ex-Pat Metheny drummer Danny Gottlieb and Paul Wertico, steel drummer Othello Molino, trumpet player Randy Brecker, and pianist-bassist Richard Drexler. He also toured with BX3, a bass conglomeration that includes the great bass players Stuart Hamm and Billy Sheehan. In 2009, Jeff toured with guitarist John Abercrombie and drummer Adam Nussbaum. Jeff also played in Asia in an explosive trio with drummer Dennis Chambers and guitarist Scott Henderson. Many have said that they've never heard anyone play with Jeff's melodic fluidity. He's making new fans all the time, while his playing continues to influence a new generation of bass players. His teaching continues to inspire and advance players wishing to know about the language of their art. Jeff Berlin is a master, and I'm proud to have my good friend from many, many years ago, Jeff Berlin, on the Evident Footprints show. Jeff, welcome to the show.
You know, after hearing all that background, I kind of want to meet me as well. I mean, who is this guy? He seems to have done so many things, and nobody seems to know about bass and music, and this guy's done all this wonderful stuff. I'm really in a lucky position, Donnie. I'm a lucky guy, buddy. I was listening to you talk, and I said, Mom must have written all that.
Either Mom or Jeff, right?
Or Jeff. Mom or Jeff. How are you, pal?
I'm going to make
a comment to people. Don Nikoloff and I coincidentally played together back in 73
and part of 74.
In Boston, and Don came and reminded me of that fact once. at a gig, and here's when you play and you're out there, you sometimes forget who you've known, or you'll remember them, their face, and how we all looked, you know, back then.
Mm-hmm.
So am I right in assuming that you came to a gig at the Iridium when I was there?
That, and also you were teaching at MIT, if you remember.
And we met there, too?
And I went there to see you, and you were rather busy at the time, so I forgave you. But here please. You are. You see, what goes around comes around.
Right on.
And
what a nice thing, man. I mean, look at us. We have history.
Yes, 37 years ago. Now, you didn't mention The Gathering at Flex. And that band had a lot of history, you know. We had Paul Weiss, who was a bass player like yourself, but he also was an excellent guitar player. And Paul was one of the original transcribers of the real book, the Jazz Bible, it became.
I'll be darned.
I don't know if you remember him. He had little spectacles, and he was already balding at a rather young age, but, man, the guy could play the pants off of a guitar and a bass.
And I don't know if you remember that we had John Scofield as our guitar player.
I remember that also. And we had Bobby Carrero, the late Bobby Carrero, on drums.
Right.
Your former roommate, Arthur Coppola, and my condolences right. to you formally. I worked with Arthur back in 2003 in Ohio. He wanted to be the next Tom Jones.
Always wanted to be. I used to walk into the flat that we shared when we were students together, and he would be singing to Tom Jones records. He'd be singing into a pencil.
Yes.
Pretending it was but we've all done air guitar and, you know, and things like that, but.
And pencil microphone.
Arthur would be going, what, Delilah, you know. Yeah, I was very saddened to hear that he passed. He was actually a very, very nice guy and a good roommate, great musician. So
yeah, he developed into somewhat of a, I have to say, he became more of a Vic Damone, if you will. He had a big band and even at times orchestra accompaniment, and he never missed a note. Even you know, he at the time I met him, he had already had developed cancer, but he didn't say anything about it. And it was not too long afterwards, we had actually made plans to co-produce his next album, and I was going to write some charts for him and do some playing on the production. And when I called to inform him that I had completed a few arrangements, I got the news that he had passed. It was really a sad day.
Well, I didn't know till you told me. It was shocking because we kind of grew up together in music during our formative years, you know.
Yes.
I spent a lot of time in Berkeley and around the Boston area back in the 70s. You know, we were all kids schlepping our guitars and our horns. And I was very fortunate because the guys that I used to schlep guitars to play with were Pat Metheny, were Mike Stern, were John Scofield, was Bill Frisell. I'm trying to remember, Vinnie Colaiuta was there, Steve Smith was there, the great studio bass player Neil Steubenhaus was there, Abraham Laboriel was there,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the guys, Billy Drews, the great horn player, was there, Gary Anderson. They were some. That was an astonishingly prolific era in music. In fact, I don't think in music there were really too many eras like it. In that period, at the exact same time that we were up north in Boston doing our thing, down in Miami area was Pat Metheny, also was there. I think Steve Morse, the guitarist, was there. Gil Goldstein was there. Jaco Pastorius and Mark Egan were bass players down there. Danny Gottlieb, one of my favorite drummers on the planet Earth, was there. I think Bruce Hornsby was a student there. So the interesting thing is, while the Boston scene was providing a kind of an atmosphere, a stimulating musical atmosphere for some real great future musicians, mostly in jazz, so was the same climate going on in South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been thrilled that I was part of that. You know, you don't know what the good things that happen to you until they go away sometimes. And when I reflect back on that, that was an era, and you were there. So, man, we would be studying all day and playing all night. I mean, I think at Flicks, were you part of that band when we had 7 days a week and we so sick from gigging 7 nights and we went up? What was the guy's name? George Graham.
Yeah.
Man, I haven't thought of that name since what, 40 years?
Mm-hmm.
And we went to him and said, we can't continue playing 7 nights a week. We had a 7-night-a-week gig, man, and we study and played music in the day. To be honest, for young people, what could possibly compare with the alive and living environment of music than studying and playing in ensembles all day long and doing your homework and learning how to arrange and practicing your instrument, and at night playing all night long only to get up the next morning and start it all over again? I tell you, buddy, we were part of a miraculous moment in music history.
Yes, we were. And, you know, there were a few other people, if I can mention some other names. Les Lumley, a prolific conga player. He was the first percussionist and probably the only one I've ever encountered who did not need a microphone. even for recording sessions. He could bang with the best of them. And the Afro-Cubano beats. And every style of music, it didn't matter. He was in the pocket. Alan Pasqua on keyboards, who made it very big with CBS, writing many of the theme musics for all the sporting events. Tim Landers, who went on to play with Journey. Gino Vannelli, I think he came just after you, a couple years after you. Bobby Green from the Boston Conservatory of Music. John Harrison was a Berkeley teacher and former student. All these guys would get together. We'd pick up the phone and say, you know, let's cut a couple of tracks. Didn't matter if it was 3 o'clock in the morning. We had a studio in Providence, Rhode Island that would open up their doors, take a couple of six packs of beer and some hot dogs and hamburgers, and we'd record all night long.
That's memories that'll never go away. And that they're intrinsically a part of us, man. And I lament that most young musicians today don't really know what we're talking about, because I don't think the climate is the same anymore like it used to be. Do you remember Claudio Roditi?
Oh, yes, trumpet player. Very good.
He was there. He was a Flicks musician along with us.
Yes.
Claudio used to play trumpet.
Yeah, he used to sit in with the band, yeah.
I tell you, man, this is life-changing stuff. And, I mean, I guess in Yiddish we call guys like me the Alter Cockers, you know, the old guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we came out of a time where playing counted, because it doesn't count much anymore. And people are more, let's say, enjoying and regarding of entertainment and music rather than music itself. And the concept of living with an instrument and practicing it for the love of it and pursuing, you know, the wonderful things that are hidden inside of a musical instrument for its own sake are just gone. I mean, I did an interview not too long ago, and I was talking about this, and somebody had a problem with my comment, and I said, well, I asked them to name any well-known group or something, and I think he mentioned Beyonce, and I said, well, what's the name of Beyonce's guitar player? And he couldn't mention it, and then we went down like Garth Brooks. I said, who's Garth Brooks' drummer? Who's name me the keyboard player who plays in The Who? The guy who actually plays in The Who. You know, there's different elements of music that attract people, but players are not it. Not like when we were younger, when players were regarded practically as God. I mean, the Mahavishnu Orchestra of that era, and John McLaughlin, and Weather Report, and Chick Corea's, the fusion of the 70s, and the great players, and even into the 80s when Eddie Van Halen became popular, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That guy is as influential in music as John Coltrane was in jazz. And And people wanted to play. People wanted to play. Today, people want to be successful.
Yes.
And I don't lament that that people want success. I want success right now, too. You know, give me success. I want it, you know. But I...
Dean, thank you.
And I want that, but you gotta earn it. And I really notice that most people don't want music in their lives anymore. Really, they don't. They talk a good talk, but a guy like me comes along, a big mouth Jeff Berlin, who says, if you want the success, you gotta pursue it. You gotta love music for its own sake, and the reward will come when it's ready to come. And, but I can't get a lot of people to recognize, you know, because the environment is not open, contingent toward, you know, music, learning how to play. Value of taking time and sounding bad.
Yeah.
Sounding bad, allowed, given permission to sound bad in music, because that's what it takes to eventually sound good. Can't have it.
Yeah.
Guys shaking their shoes for the idea of making a mistake in a practice room. Just unbelievable, this weird era of music we're in.
Yeah, and I suppose we could blame a lot of the mainstream major record labels for that, because they commercialized everything, and then they really lowered the bar, you know. And we have shows like American Idol where you hear some good talent, and they don't pick the talent. They want to dumb us down. I get that impression. They do it in every other aspect of our lives. Why not in music?
Oh, I 100% agree. And I think it wouldn't be such thing to include musical entertainment to coincide with music, but it's not the case anymore. And the problem I have with American Idol or Dance Your A Off or Dancing with the Stars or all of these programs is that they've taken vocalists and made them today's musicians.
Mm-hmm.
There's that funny joke where the girl singer's in the band, and the band leader says to her, like on this next tune, when we come in, like on G major, I want you to come in a half beat early. I want you to descend to the F sharp. Then I want you to not necessarily sing quite in pitch in the second bar. And then I want you to forget the words in the third. And then I want you to scream as high as you can in the fourth bar. And she says, man, I don't think I can do all that. And the guy says, well, why not? You did it last night.
Yeah.
So, and the nature of that is to explain that vocalists are now musicians when, in general, I generalize here, you'll have, you know, Tony Bennett, and you will have great singers, but most vocalists don't know anything about music. In fact, vocalizing is such a common practice that shows, as you were discussing, are designed around it. It's really not hard to find in every little small suburb in America, in Europe, anywhere else. There's always a couple of guys that really sing well. Why? Because it is not necessarily a musically challenging thing to do this. The irony, I guess, is the awful singer, in which y'all, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, I always love to watch the first week of American Idol and see these people that come in that, you know, can't sing whatsoever, and really get indignant when when those guys say, you know, you really can't sing. I'm going to show him. I'm going to be the biggest thing, you know. And so I don't particularly feel comfortable with the idea that music is not a part of music, and that these shows have totally superseded anything that takes place in terms of involving oneself in music. Singing is a form of communication. It's an art form, but it isn't entirely musical unless one uses and employs music within the singing experience. And what I had also wished for is when you have an act that sells 15 million CDs in the world, that I wish that the funds and the monies earned by these acts might be used in some regard to subsidize players who are great players, but who are not heard, are not seen, are not publicized. As we get on in our little chat, I've sent a few select letters to different guys at different times and said, you know, if you're going to continue promoting vocals, how about a good musician, a great guitar player? I can't think of a really, let's say, well-known guitarist who came out in the last 3-4 years that made the impact like 50 Cent or any rapper, which entertains people. Rap itself isn't music because it's lyric, it's word,
mm-hmm.
and done in a rhythmical fashion. Music is rhythm, melody, and harmony, mm-hmm. some form, you know, a combination of the three. And having the ability to rhyme words is not necessarily a musical skill requiring of training, or certainly it's something that comes more naturally to some guys. They use it in a certain way. It's a fun thing, and nothing beats rhythm to excite people anyway. So, I don't knock these things, but are they really music, and do they have the value to receive the attention that they do? It's like, let's say a lot of the music of today or the entertainment of today is as musically meaningful, I think, as professional wrestling is a meaningful sport. Now, the wrestlers have gotten together and at least had the good taste to say, you know what? It's the entertainment that we do.
Yes.
And I admire that. It used to be fun when we used to think that Rowdy Roddy Piper really was mad at Jimmy the Superfly Snuka, you know. And, you know, we weren't sure if what was that guy, George the Animal Steel?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Remember him? Yeah. You know how he got his green tongue? He used to chew on a Clorets before he went out into the wrestling ring. But if people get indignant about the idea that I might, or people like me, say that these things aren't music, it's simply a case when you identify what music is and identify what entertainment is and how the two can combine. Look at Norah Jones.
Mm-hmm.
The two can combine. You can find great entertainment in music. But in today's day and age, turn on a Burger King commercial, rock and roll. There's a couple of these kid shows, you know, the teenagers are, you know, we got to get together for the band contest. And, you know, the dangerous element of rock and roll is over, man. It's entertainment and pablum, and it's sweet and it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that I would see more of the players that are so necessary to be showcased and popularized. But I really don't see that. Do you? I mean, do you really see much of that?
No, I don't. I'm in agreement with you. If we can switch gears just for a few minutes here.
Switch yeah. away.
I want to, we've whetted the appetites of the listening audience, and probably they're thirsty on top of it. So I'm going to feature, the first track on your new release, CD release, High Standards, a very well-known song called Groovin' High.
Right.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
To say, Jeff, did you have to call the fire department on that one? Number one, a couple of things come to mind. We want to acknowledge your, can't really call them sidemen, Richard Drexler on the piano and Danny Gottlieb on drums. Just fantastic playing. Dizzy woke up on that one, too. Dizzy Gillespie, the composer for that song. Just awesome.
Well, these guys are far from sidemen, you know, and I've always had a little bit of a kind of a nervous thing when I'm around great musicians, because I always knew that great musicians know the truth about, you know, about musicians. So reputation, schmeputation, and all of that stuff aside, when we play together, I really hope that I can be worthy. You know, these guys know, their ears are too good. They know. So I when we did this tune, it was really a kind of a sigh of relief for me, because it was a good version of this tune. We got a little hyper in it. We sped it up a little bit, because I utterly dismiss anything that, you know, as a leader, that has anything to do with click tracks whatsoever. And we moved, we breathed, we sped, we this and that. It's human. It's just a lovely version of that song, and it's an honor, man. It's, I can hear that and not cringe too badly. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Your playing is awesome. It always was. I mean, if you can imagine, ladies and gentlemen, this guy played like that 36, 37 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, no, I didn't.
No, you did. You did. You expanded, but, you know, you had the same foundational technique, but the same soul and the ear and the feel, everything, you know.
Ah, you're a sweet guy, man. I remember as being younger that this is before the remarkable impact that Jaco Pastorius had laid on all of us. But even before him, I have a violin background, so it occurred to me that this instrument might be useful in slightly non-traditional ways. And really, there weren't anybody who soloed. So I would go to the pianists and the sax players, and not the guitarists for some reason, but the trumpet players like you. You know, I would go to these guys and transcribe and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And try to emulate some of that stuff, because they were, these are instruments, of course, designed to play other than boom, 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 boom. And I liked that also. I liked being a fundamental bassist. It was fun, but it wasn't all that challenging. And I really kept hearing the idea of doing something unique, you know, hopefully. And it's still my modus operandi. I'm, you know, like I said, I'm 57. I'll be 58 in January. And I'm practicing tomorrow. You know, I want to know more about this. And so when we were kids together, you and I, and playing at Flicks, we'll let this enthusiasm coupled with, you know, what were we back there? 22, 21,
yeah, 20, something. Yeah. We're in our 20s, 22, 23.
You know, we were kids, but we were fired up, man. You want to play, like you said, hey, let's play. Let's go to the studio and jam, man. What a legacy, you know, what a wonderful thing to have that. And this little tune you just played is my 2010 version of that same hyper love for music that we all had when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Now, you know, the average listener out there that listens to music and they say, well, you know, it's like the old saying, jazz, there's too many notes, you know. it's really difficult to explain. Like you said, you know, I had a background in classical music for many years. And, I mean, who ever heard of kids right. practicing 10 to 12 hours a day on the weekend? And I can remember my parents coming to the basement door to tell me it was 2 or 3 in the morning, it was time to go to bed because I had to get up at 6 for school. You know,
wow.
That's what we did. And I think when you're that driven, you're in touch with something that many people struggle with their whole life until they actually realize, you know, it was music I always wanted to do. If you know what I mean, we knew this as children. We came to this planet knowing that we were going to contribute to the music on a very high level. The intention is to honor the art form, you know, to perform aesthetically and inspire people. And it has an impact ultimately in raising the vibration of the planet.
Right.
What better calling is there?
Well, I so agree with you. I could, and anyone listening can associate it with anything. I mean, the zeal for gardening, the zeal for painting, the zeal for dance, the zeal for singing. I mean, yeah. I didn't mean to ignore that it has value. The zeal for anything, for cooking. I wish I were a better cook. Some people are into sports. The joy of, I don't know, throwing a ball better, catching it better, or running better, you know. that's the wonderful thing. But as kids, we were just so fired up about it. And I laugh at that too many note thing, because too many notes is like too many words. It's I agree one can rabbit, but something more than pay me needs to be uttered, you know, in a communication. And that might be better to say, you know, Mr. Smith, can I come in and get my paycheck at 3 o'clock, sir, if you're free? You know, that might be a lot of work. So I don't like the concept, and I've heard it before, about the leaner form of playing, that the blues must be a more pure form of music because these guys didn't play many notes. These guys didn't play many notes because they didn't know how.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why they didn't play many notes. And in our case, harmony is something that most people, you know, they certainly know the word and they may understand the general implication of it. But harmony to us as players means that this chord exists and this chord has to be represented somehow.
Mm-hmm.
My folly is that I'm on a bass guitar doing it. It's like, you know, if you get a Don Nikoloff and, you know, playing trumpet, you must play melody. I don't necessarily have to. I could be a bass player and sort of do that. But the need to represent those chords came from the needs to look for notes. And who was it? Bob Geldof said something once which I totally dismissed. Something about that you only need two or three chords and like two or three melody notes to music. And I thought, well, for him, yes, because that's all the music the man may know. And I'm not saying that as a derogatory statement, but if I justify the fact that all I can cook is eggs and hot dogs and then feel like I have to say, you know, it's really, who needs to cook with spices and with sauces and with, you know, bouillabaisse and with all these things, you know, who needs to poach, you know, what kind of an example is that to share in regards to the art of cooking? To limit yourself and then justify the limitation just because somebody doesn't know how to cook that well.
And then,
so it's, sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I thought you had concluded your statement.
Sure.
I was just going to add that Nicholas Leninsky, in his introduction to his Thesaurus of Scales and Melodic Patterns, calculated over 12 million possibilities of arranging melodies for creating songs. And that thick, what was it, about an inch thick book, and it was a very large book, just filled with black pages of 16th notes in every melodic pattern you could imagine. He analyzed music back hundreds of years and brought it up to date that you could practice that book and then practice it not just in the key of C, but transpose it in 11 other key signatures, or technically 14 other key signatures, and develop some chops, develop some technique, and an innate understanding of pitch relationships and harmonies and rhythms, all the things you're talking about.
Well, I have that book here. That I use the Leninsky book for pretty much those reasons too. There's some ideas in there that are just kind of unreal. Coltrane, I know, practiced out of that book.
Yeah,
you know,
that's the other end of the spectrum. And the reason I bring that up is, you know, two or three notes and two or three chords. I mean, there's millions of possibilities. There's no end to the possibilities. Yeah.
Which also brought up a kind of a saying that I sort of dismiss, which is they say, and you may have heard this, I'm sure you have, that no matter how much we practice, we musicians, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard that, right?
Oh, yes, of course.
And I dismiss that comment because the comment applies to everything. No matter how much study in the law you've done, you haven't even scratched the surface with usages and manipulations of precepts and principles and law. No matter how many meals you've cooked or innovated in as a chef, as a gastronome, no matter what you've done, you haven't even scratched the surface. And if that is true, then it almost implies what's the point of even trying. And because of the fact that I know as a musician, I'm pretty much never going to really get anywhere remotely close to those 10 million Leninsky examples that he mentioned, I'm okay with the fact that maybe I can get, you know, 50. And that's fine with me because that I can deal with. It fits my humanity. It fits the fact that I can adjust to it and delve into these 50 to 100, whatever it is, you know, and do it with a proper approach, and play as a musician with some authority. I mean, so I kind of said, yeah, sure, you know, no matter how much we scratch. So what's the point? So the point is go for 12, go for 15. I tell guys who want to learn music, you know, don't play well. Practice it. Don't worry about getting it. You'll get it eventually anyways. Everybody does. So anyways, just a 2 cents because I'm on the radio, so I'm sharing with you.
Yeah. No, this is valuable conversation for anybody out there because there are people listening who are in the music business that can certainly learn something from what you have to share. You've done it. You've been there and done it.
Well, I can certainly share one thought, which is kind of a fact of I'm a good truth sayer, and truth really can bother a person more than the fantasy of it. The fantasy of it is that if you play guitar or play in rock, you know, you'll get successful or certainly get a gig or certainly get a studio job. And the cruel truth is you probably won't. And the reason is because everybody shares the same aspirations as guitar players and bass players and musicians. We all want that gig. We all want that rock success. We all want that studio job. What separates the men from the boys is that the really serious musicians are willing to not get that gig until they're darn good and ready to get it. One of the awful elements that I have had to do, let's say, as a guy with a reputation is my rep is often that I'm arrogant. And I thought, why am I arrogant? If I were really arrogant, then I would not do anything to make anybody mad at me and just sort of butter it up and feed my arrogance. Hey, man, everybody loves me. But I discovered that if I can tell people a truth or two, whether they like it or not, Gandhi said, even if a minority of one speaks the truth, the truth is the truth. And the truth is that there is a real minority of people who are willing to not get that gig until they're ready. So I've told guys, they'll say like, why don't I practice? And if I get a studio gig, what if the Stones come into the studio and call me up on a session and then my amp is here and what'll I do? And I say, well, don't worry about that because the Stones are never going to call you. And they get a little miffed at me about that. I said, if you want to even remotely approach any kind of success in music, you can't jump the gun and get into the gigs that you're not deserving to get. And that if you lay back a little bit and do, let's say, regional gigs like you and I, Flix, we're talking about this club, Flix. This was a club. It was a gig in a hotel at the time that young musicians like you and I played. And that was the foundation to provide some kind of motion in our musical lives. You ended up in a radio studio and you're still an arranger and you're still playing. I went on another path and sort of became so-called innovator on the electric bass guitar. And that's the beauty of things is things come when they're ready to come. But you tell a young kid that he isn't ready to get that gig, man, and they're going to get real mad at you.
Well, the funny thing is if Mick Jagger did give him a call to do a gig in the studio, he's got enough money to call SRI to rent an amp. You know, he shouldn't
exactly
worry about that. Those things work themselves out, you know.
They always do because do you happen to recall when Rod Stewart came to Flix one night with his band and had a drink?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Were you there? Were we working together at that particular time?
Yeah.
Rod is over in the bar and he's having a drink. Now, hypothetically, you know, you or I might have played and somebody might have, you know, you might have gotten a rock gig. You never know where or how it's going to come about, but you got to be ready for it. And you start by doing the simplest, most dismal, most sort of low class type of playing situations, play in your friend's house. You play in a high school dance. You play, you know, you do regional little small clubs like I did as a teen, and you do it for the love of music, playing and learning, man. Oh, my gosh. If I could get the young people of this generation to back up a little bit and stop looking for the gold ring when they're not qualified yet to get it, they would triple their playing. They would quadruple their opportunities. And the thing is that I basically talk on deaf ears. I mean, there's always one guy out of 199 guys who sort of plot to find holes in my logic. It's an odd, quirky thing. But I'd rather people know that you're going to get what you want, but you got to learn how to play first if that's your interest.
Yeah. Now, don't you find it interesting, Jeff, that since going back to the time you and I were playing together, right. How many people were there on the planet? Well, less than 5 billion, and we're approaching almost another 2 billion population since that time. And yes, the gigs seem to be less and less, though there is more listeners out there. Isn't that an interesting phenomenon?
Yeah, there's more players or more people wishing to play and less opportunities to play. They had another little, which was back in 1971, a house cost about $25,000. A car cost, let's say, $2,500, $3,000. And a gig would pay, you know, $50 to $100. And today, a house can cost upwards of $700,000 to $800,000. A car today costs easily $40,000 to $50,000, and a gig pays around $50 to $100.
Yeah, it's like gold, isn't it?
That's, the gigs never went up in prices.
Yes.
I mean, I even heard of a friend, you know, on the, you know, the historical, you get more money on New Year's Eve type of thing, you know, for, mm-hmm. for guys that are doing like the that type of. I did it back then. You probably did it, you know. Sure. Where we were for hire, we wanted to do those New Year's Eve gigs because they paid so well. Man, I know of a guy who complained that the guy wouldn't give it to him because he couldn't afford it. And even that tradition is compromised. I mean, I don't want to talk dark here. I want to say is that anybody who wants to do music and really want to do, let's say, because I'm talking to those guys now. We're getting into some other elements, you know, entertainment and what's going on. But anybody into music, you can do it, but you've got to pay the price for it because everybody in law school pays a price to be a lawyer. Everyone in medical school pays that price. Everybody at the CIA, I'm talking about the Culinary Institute, you know, the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America, they pay a price, man. They pay a price. People pay prices. They work for what they want. They pursue it, and they don't let anyone tell you they don't suffer a little bit in the pursuit of doing something special in their life. Except our industry. My industry, some schnooky guitar magazine editor says, yeah, man, you can do it. You can get it. And I'm saying, no, you can't. You'll get it if you pursue it. Then you can get it, you know, because it's popular, you know, to tell a guy, you know, how to get a gig. You're not going to get a gig till you can play. And I want that to make sense so that we'll cut out the BS and, you know, get away from the phony direction toward, let's say, accomplishing something in music and get to the factual end of things, how they, what they can do in order to become good musicians. I mean, 98% of the music schools today are full of beans. They're full of beans because they're not teaching music. They're teaching performance classes. They're teaching licks. They're teaching rock classes, man. There's no historical validation whatsoever for rock education. You can't name three guys on the planet Earth who are known musicians in rock who ever will claim that they got their skills studying rock and roll or rock classes or rock schools. It just doesn't exist. And the nature of music education is so compromised now. Why? Because the students don't really want to learn music. And that's, in my case, is I won't give a student what he wants. I'll give a student what he needs. And those are the guys that I attract, let's say, who come to study with me sometimes. And, you know, the guys who know this, and they're the guys who always seem to get better. Because, and guys like me, you know, I'm sure like you, like-minded guys who want to show musical content to people. And forget the nonsensical fantasy. I call it Disneyland music studies.
Yeah.
They're fake.
Yeah, you're right. You're really right. And, you know, we, as jazz students, we studied classical music and classical techniques to master the instrument, to be able to play those things. And classical music was a perfect medium to learn how to play the instrument correctly. then you can decide what you're capable of transferring that knowledge to, and your feeling comes out then, because I'm going to feel different playing a classical piece than I am a jazz piece or a funk piece, you know, R&B or oompa music. It all has its own feel, you know, and I've been successful in all those areas because of the foundation in classical music. So I couldn't agree with you more that they should pay the dues before they play the blues. Let's put it that way.
Bingo. And speaking of oompa, I got to apologize because I just did an oompa right here. So please excuse me. You didn't get that joke, did you?
I did.
Okay.
I'm gonna give us.
Oh man, the room is full of oompa. Listen, you mentioned something very funny, interesting. Again, is the thing about feeling, and they have also in music education, there is a big emphasis about telling people about how to get in touch with their feelings, get in touch with your inner musician. I don't know if you've ever heard that too.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of another nonsensical approach to music, because the idea is that one would actually pay money to a school or a class or an event or something in order to find a way to get in touch with their emotions in music. The nonsense about it is that everybody plays with emotion. Even the guys that can only play a little bit, everybody plays with emotion.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay money to get in touch with your musicality. The reason you pay money is to learn what music is on your instrument. It is the only basic central reality in academics. And this is also, I think, stirred things up with people with me, because I do go in the face of, I would say, the majority of people when I tell them don't practice with metronomes, don't use tablature, don't use hand grips. Don't practice string crossing exercises. Don't practice chops building exercises. Don't use anything that requires your hands to squeeze or strain or stretch. You know, any of these things are basically replacements for musical content. If people learn music, they'd be playing, man. They'd mm-hmm. be playing.
Yeah.
They would be playing. So I realize I'm not a popular fellow for this, but I like, again, that Gandhi quote, even if the minority view of one speaks the truth, that's what it is. It is the truth. So, and, oh wait, there was a, I was going to ask people, people had problem I tell people to play out of time, not play in time. I don't know if you're aware of that or understand, maybe that might even be new to you, that a metronome is pretty much a detriment to anyone learning how to play in time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it keeps you locked in a box, and you're constricted rhythmically, you know. I mean, it's like being in the Matrix.
Yeah.
I agree. Or click it, right? Is, you know.
Well, learning is about taking time to regard. That's what a learning a moment is. That's what a practice or a lesson is.
Mm-hmm.
Time to regard something. And when teachers pop on a click, they're providing an environment for their students whereby the students don't have time to regard the yep. information that they're learning. And they've completely damaged the lesson format by trying to get guys to play in time. And time has never been a click issue anyway. And teachers are wrong about that. And so they get a little miffed at me about. I'm making a list of all the things that people are miffed at me about. It's growing. You notice as the more we talk?
Well, I think there's a modicum of tempo that can be induced so that the student can become a proficient player and feel the time, if you will. Feel it so much that you forget the time is there, you know, or you
and
notice the time.
I agree, and I think that sensation comes from knowledge of how to play. That I've noticed that people who don't know how to function on an instrument as well as they might if they learn more music, they will always play out of time. And I've noticed that people that know their instrument and know the language of the song that they're playing, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That they always seem to play in time. I've never known a well-known drummer who didn't play in time. I realize everyone has their human sort of sensibilities about where the quarter note goes, but in my entire career, I mean, even back then with Guerrero, I don't recall anybody that I've ever played with just about that didn't play in time. I almost don't remember any musician, because time is such a faction of the requirement of playing. If anyone played, then time had to be in there. It's almost like you can't live without a heart. You can't live without your liver. You can't live without your kidney. So you got to take for granted the fact that all of these organs are going to be in play in order to provide for a healthy body. In music, it's the same thing, that you got to, let's say, represent the harmony of the piece. You want to play in tune, and you want to play in time. So because these are such non-negotiable realities, it honestly, ironically, makes me laugh when people keep pushing time down the throats of so many musicians as if it was such a unique principle to be regarded, and it isn't. And again, I mentioned I almost can't remember anybody who didn't play in time. I mean, just almost anybody. We're talking, what are we, 73, you and I used to hang out, 83, 93, mm-hmm. We're talking almost 40 years here, 37 years, where I can't remember a gig with a drummer and thought to myself, man, this guy has no time. Or bass players, this guy has no time. I mean, listen to a horn section. How many big bands did you ever play in and actually notice that the horns were not happening? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I've heard plenty of bands like that, but I never played with them.
And the bands that played like that, were they like the student bands, or were they like, certainly not, let's say, Mel, what am I thinking of, Thad Jones, Mel Lewis.
Thad Jones and Mel Lewis, or Stan Kenton.
Or Stan Kenton.
Woody Herman.
Right.
You know, Butch Rich.
You know, you never hear these things from these guys.
Maynard Ferguson, he always had a, you know, yeah, you never have that problem. Because everybody paid their dues and took care of business.
Bingo. You Bingo. Know,
let's take a breather here.
Cool.
I'm surprising you with what I'm going to play, but this is pertinent to what you're talking about here. I'm going to have the listening audience join in with you guys on Body and Soul.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
From the album High Standards, Jeff Berlin, Richard Pressler, and Danny Gottlieb, and Body and Soul, with keyboard accompaniment in the background. I don't know if you heard your keyboard coming through there. I thought.
Oh, it was?
Oh, yeah. I thought you were getting into some Brazilian percussion there for a moment the first time I heard it.
Oh man, I didn't know. Is it you mean when you're playing music, I'm still on the air?
We're live. Yeah, we're on voice over internet protocol. So
boy, I'm glad I didn't log onto that website during these musical interludes.
Anyway, it's okay. That's for posterity's sake.
That's why I was typing. I thought I was off the. I thought I was off the air right then and there.
Yeah, I want to comment during that interlude there. That's just absolutely fantastic playing, man. It's so spiritual, and yet it grooves, it swings. Everything, all the elements are there. Anything that people look for in jazz music is in that performance. As the founder of the Player School, I was saying to myself, thank God for people like Jeff Berlin, because he's going to teach a lot of people how to really play the bass. and it's going to keep standards of music from dying with what we're experiencing these days. And, you know, the mass mind control of technological inventions that really take the heart out of the music. You know, everything is nothing against synthesis, because if properly done, it can be a really beautiful thing. But it's almost like we're creating artificial music. Everything, you know, on a popular scale, I'm saying, you know, on a commercial scale. And, you know, the fact that you have a school where you teach these principles to students, and if they really get it, they're gonna be hitting the top, like you said. They'll be very successful and very satisfied.
They'll certainly have the tools to do more than, let's say, hope for a gig. Yeah, the Players School, I started that because my son got cancer when he was 5, and I put my bass in my closet. I completely retired as a bass player, and I said, I'm staying home. I'm not going to go anywhere until whatever happens with my son will happen. Either he'll get well or, you know, something else. So to make a living, I've always been a pretty good clinician. I've always been a very good sort of shower of musical information. I mean, even a non-bassist, I just a knack, and I've done it for so many years. And I've also studied with the best teachers you could get. I mean, over the years that I've been with these people, something rubbed off, and I became a really good lecturer on music. And I started the school, the Players School of Music, and stayed home. And my son got cured. He actually is completely cured. He's 18. He's almost 18 now.
Wow.
He knows oh, it's amazing. And I kept to the credo that we get a lot of guys that are not readers. And I told guys that want to come here that for all my firm sort of belief about how one ought to go about learning, the actual truth is I am maybe the easiest going guy in the world with the methods that people use to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is that we have guys that have just bought a guitar and have flown to Clearwater, Florida to study. And in 1 or 2 days, I repeat, 1 or 2 days, they're reading already. Mm-hmm. In a simple manner, mind you, but people have this sort of wrong notion about what it takes in order to become a good musician. And I tell guys the first thing to do is, one, allow mistakes and practice at a time. You got to count a little bit. You got to fix your mistakes, and you're allowed to make a billion errors as you're learning. I mean, I almost encourage people to just put out, you know, a welcome mat for Mr. Mistake, because he's coming, and just take the time. And do you know, man, that I have 100% improvement rate here at the Players School of Music? That's 100%.
Yeah, that's
of
great.
Guys that get better. And the reason is because they're supposed to get better at their own pace, not the pace I lay down for them. Mm-hmm.
I think only Al Gore could do a better job than that.
Well, Al did lie. I'm the guy that invented the internet. Al was so, man, that made me so mad. And I was telling my good friend Frank Sinatra about it just yesterday, too.
Well, I'm after this show, I'm going to modify my outlook on global warming, because when Jeff Berlin's playing, there is a rise in temperature, a degree or two.
Oh, that's funny. That's so sweet. You know what? I wish to goodness sakes I can get people to come and see what a bass player can do live, man, and check out, or go to anybody's show. That's a bona fide musician. Go to the jazz clubs and see what it is. You know, I mean, music is more than lasers.
Well, I've got two questions for you, and this is to give some information to the listening audience as well. The first one is, and I'm going to lay them out before I want you to answer them, okay? The first one is...
In other words, Jeff, shut up, right?
Okay. Well, no. Where are you gigging in the Clearwater area or around the country in the near future that people can come and see live? And when is the session going to be booked that I'm going to be joining you?
Okay, I'll answer both questions. In Clearwater, I never play because they don't like what I do here. In Tampa, generally, they don't like what I do here. I've done 3 attempts at playing in this town, and 3 times I've struck out. And the reason is because I don't do Jimmy Buffett, and you can't dance to what I do. So I take that in stride, man.
Yeah.
That's the reality. I'm okay with it. So I've never gig in Tampa or Clearwater ever, unless it's maybe the Jazz Festival. They did me an honor. They did me a real honor. They gave me the opening slot. They gave me the spot on Saturday night just ahead of Chick Corea's band.
Oh, wow.
Which means I had the whole place was just filled, and we played great. And that alone is the reward for people, that wonderful opportunity to hear, you know, badass musicians doing their thing. So, but other than that, I played a couple of places. I took small gigs, you know, like the gigs I was suggesting to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have to tell you this because it's kind of funny. I remember one I played at a place called Gators, and people, the music, I was with Danny Gottlieb and Richard Drexler. And we decided to play our hearts out. We really wanted to win these people over. And people started to get up and leave. So the club owner came up and he paid us and he said, could you guys stop now and go home? And when we stopped, people started to come back into the club. So that was that gig. And then later I tried another gig, actually around the corner from where I live. It's a restaurant bar. And people were in the club waiting to dance. And when we started the play, they all left the dance floor and they all went into the bar. So, and there was a third gig, and I can't, that was the one out in Tampa at the, what was that restaurant? It was the 224 Club. I got fired from that club because a waitress, but how can I say this? Let me ask you a question. Can I speak plainly here or no?
Well, we in some parts of the world, we have kids listening to the show.
Okay, then I'll make it gentle.
If you can use a symbology, that might work. You know.
Okay, the symbiology begins right here. I was fired from a gig because a waitress complained because she thought that I was, let's say, engaged, that I was, man. I am a slob because I can't think of a synonym for this. She thought that I was larger than I should have been. And that's a true story, you know, and for all the art films that I've seen in my adult life, waitresses usually don't get shocked and upset when somebody's sort of walking around in a slightly larger situation. You know what I mean? They usually will hit you over the head and drag you behind the bar, at least according to all the art films that I've seen. But in this case, it wasn't true anyway, because no musician can, let's say, enlarge themselves while they're in the midst of a solo. Your mind doesn't work like that. You know that.
Yes.
I don't care who's in the audience. If you're playing, you're not going to be thinking around those particular regions. But I honestly got fired because a waitress complained that she thought I was, let's say, prematurely large and looked at me on a stage from out in the audience and noticed my appearance in that area and determined that I was, let's say, more healthily, you know, indicating.
Now, were you playing violin or bass?
Bass, baby. I was playing bass, man, and I got fired for having a schmeckle. And I went, what? And I didn't even have it. So that taught me that Tampa, Florida, just, I don't know what the deal is. And I love the town because I'm a true Floridite.
Mm-hmm.
I love Florida. I love this state. I absolutely love this state. But they're just musically not into what I do. And certainly one waitress wasn't into me at all. So, but that was three. That's a funny story to me. And then people walking out when we playing, and then when we stop playing, they walk back in. Yeah.
Now, if you go back there by accident, you may be surprised to find out that the waitress married the owner.
Oh, that might be it.
And now she runs the place.
Oh, God. If she runs the place, I'll never get a gig there. But doesn't that go against everything you hear about or think about modern female sort of,
especially if you turn on the TV today, it's nothing but Enzyte and Extends commercials, you know. So
that's right. That's right. Extends. Not that I know anything about Extends or anything.
Why don't
I heard about
somebody
it
at the TV station, you know, for showing those commercials.
Good point.
It's a crazy world.
It wasn't like when we were kids. You remember flicks?
Yes.
People, they were a lot more relaxed about those things than I imagine today. But there you go. That's neither here nor there. It's probably not appropriate radio conversation. I just wanted to lay out why let me rephrase that, not lay out. I was trying to explain why I don't work in the Tampa Bay area. But I am going in November. I'm going to Central and South America. We have a tour there, and that's going to be fun. And then, yeah, let's play, man. You want to play horn on the next session, man? Maybe you can arrange it, too.
I would love to. Oh, man.
I'm not a very good arranger. I mean, I can do it mechanically, but it's not my thing, you know?
Oh, I would be honored to do that.
Maybe we can do something.
Yes. There's so many things I want to say here, and we're running out of time. But I have to say, you know, you mentioned flicks, and you remember the swimming pool that was in the club?
Oh, very well.
Okay.
And you remember what happened every Saturday night around that pool?
And I used to play, we used to play Also Sprach Zarathustra, but we used Eomir Deodato's arrangement, the funky version.
Yes.
And as you're building that climax, dun, 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 okay, I was walking backwards on the diving board of the pool, and inevitably I would dive into the pool with my gig clothes on, with my horn, depending on which horn I was playing, and I would go underwater and come up and actually blow water out the horn. That has to be a Guinness Book of World Records.
That's funny. I remember I think I saw you do it once, if I'm not mistaken. I think when you were playing with David Holt's father, you played in a band with, what was the guy's name?
Oh, Gene Hull.
Gene Hull.
Yeah.
And I remember around the pool that, remember Nick Gravelis?
Oh, yes.
Nick Gravelis was a connected guy, a very tough, rough, badass individual, and he loved the musicians. And he was always running around the pool when some girl decided to take her clothes off and dive in. I don't know if you remember
I do remember that.
So that pool was a source of entertainment for all of us.
See, that was the time when they used to streak, you know, in stadiums and clubs and stuff. And, yeah, they would dive in that pool. That was some place, I'll tell you. And you remember Charlie Pappas, too. He owned the whole kit and caboodle, the apartment complex and the club. And
I remember.
Yeah, he was from the old school, but he never, ever complained about anything. We never had somebody say, would you turn the music down, or would you play something slow, or play something fast, or, you know, half-assed.
That's true, Charles. That's true. No one ever bothered us. And you remember the name of the guy who booked the club? It was George Graham?
Yes.
Remember him?
Mm-hmm. I do.
And Nick? And I saw Nick knock a guy out once. I saw Nick knock a guy out once. Nick was, 5'6" or 5'7", and if you remember him, and just for our listeners, he had a permanent grimace on his face.
And a
his
tuxedo.
Eyes,
yeah,
he and was a tuxedo.
Yeah.
Just a permanent, dark, mean, watch-out look. But he was a sweet guy to always was. And I saw him out there, and it was this big dude. I mean, it sounds like a TV stereotype fight here, but the guy was 6'4". He was a big, strong guy, and he was yelling at Nick. And Nick said, sir, you're going to have to leave. You're going to have to leave. I'm sorry, sir. Please leave. I don't want any trouble. And I saw the guy throw a punch at Nick out in the lobby there, you know, when you go out the front door there.
Yeah.
And I saw Nick reach back, and I heard the sound. I can still hear it now. It was terrible, man. Nick clocked this guy one shot, and this guy fell straight back and flat out like a TV knockout, you know? Mm-hmm. Hands out to the sides, and the other guys were there, and they held Nick back. But Nick was not someone you messed with. And I never forgot that. But he was a fun guy with us. He was a funny, funny guy. He used to grab me and, like, grab my nipple, you know, and he squeezed hard, and I would go, Nickley. He goes, get your damn hands off me, you know, like that. Okay, Nick, I'm not holding him. And then he'd let go and smile at me, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a rough, bad boy, but it was a funny, kind of cool environment. I'm just remembering these stories now because I'm, you know, talking to you. You know, ah, Nicky, man, it was a fun time. And then we get up and play. How cool is that?
Yeah, it was. And, you know, we had competition in Boston, too, with the jazz clubs on Boylston Street. And we did well. We always had a full house, and people stayed the whole night. Even the professional athletes would come in to listen to us, and we'd know them by their first names after
That's
a while.
Right. I remember, what was that? I can't remember him now. The Boston, a lot of the Red Sox would come in.
Charlie Veal used to come in and drink Galliano and milk. That was his drink. He was a pitcher.
Who was that guy? McHale?
Kevin McHale would come
in. Yeah, he came in. Who was that super tall basketball? Havlicek.
Yeah,
remember
John
Havlicek,
and
he would come in.
Bill Russell.
Did Bill Russell come in? I don't know if I met him.
Yeah.
I knew the professional wrestlers would come in. Andre the Giant came in. Do you remember
that's
that?
Right. I remember.
And Chief J. Strongbow, because I think a couple of these guys used to work out at the gym down the hall there.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, man. Yeah, that was a fun gig, man. We had the best gig in Boston.
And we had the best Polynesian food in town in the basement of the building.
Yeah, right down those stairs.
The was it called the Tiki Tiki or something like that?
Something, the Tiki, yeah. I remember that downstairs. Oh, man, I forgot about that. Absolutely true. And, you know, if you go out the door and you make a left turn, you're in Kenmore Square in like 5 seconds. You go right on.
Yeah.
On the way there. And I used to walk around Kenmore, and I had this memory very clearly. And there was a club, and I can't remember the name, but if you go on the right side of Kenmore, there's a little alley. And I would go down there just to see what bands were playing. And on the blackboard one time, it said, tonight, you know, two shows, and written in chalk, tonight two shows Aerosmith. And I remembered it. I don't know why, but that stuck with me. So what a funny name for a band. And they were playing down that alley in Boston when you and I were playing up the street.
Yeah, that's amazing.
What was that other club in Kenmore Square? Lucifer's?
Lucifer's.
Is that the name?
Yeah, Lucifer's.
But I played there with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Yeah, they had the bigger, you know, the B-acts, the more famous B-acts were there usually. You know, our gig at Flicks was how I ended up with Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders too. That's when I ended up leaving and I met Jocko at that time.
Was he in the band?
Yeah, he was in the band. Of course he left shortly after that and, not because I joined, I hope.
I'm certain of that, buddy.
No, he got the weather report gig, you know, that started manifesting itself.
Did you play those Charlie Brent charts?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ming of Mings, and I can't remember a couple of the other ones he did.
Circles was my most favorite tune that Wayne did. This song was like 20 minutes long, and we used to stand on the tables.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah, he'd tear the house down on that.
Did you play with Alan Robinson?
Yes.
I've been in touch with him. We for some reason got interested to email each other. And for people listening, Alan Robinson is the drummer.
Yeah.
Was the drummer with Wayne Cochran. He's now in New Orleans, and I think he's
he was a Stax drummer too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He played on a lot of the original Stax stuff. Oh, yeah. He was funk drummer.
I'll be darned. I'll be darned. I got more into the funk when I got to New York and, you know, started to record and play in the city. And that's when I started to, let's say, play a lot more R&B. I played with Pee Wee Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
James Brown's horn player, who's the guy who actually wrote The Chicken.
Yeah.
And then I got into Latin music playing with Ray Barreto and did jingles. I even did a session for Joe Frazier.
Oh, wow.
I was part of a jingle company, and when they were using real musicians back then, and they said they had a session with Joe. He wanted to do a demo, and I begged him, because I'm a boxing fan, and I love Joe Frazier, and I begged him. I said, let me be the bass player. So I met Joe, and he told me a funny story. I even remember it to this day. He's referring to his new business, and he says, Jeff, he says, I'm going into business. This is Joe Frazier now. I remember this. He says, I'm going into business. I'm going into the sausage business. He says, I'm going to call it Smokin' Joe's Sausage. And he said to me, it's made out of beef, so even the Muslims can eat it. And he was referring to Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted me to know that even a Muslim like Muhammad Ali could eat a sausage because it was made out of beef.
Oh.
Smoking Joe. Hey, Jeff, what do you know? Gosh darn it, man. Music is the thing that opened the doors and got me all over the world. Music got me on your show. Music got me to play at Flicks, to meet Joe Frazier, to eat foods that few people in the world have ever eaten, to see things few people have ever seen, to meet people few people get to meet, to be in places. Music is the greatest door of diplomacy and the greatest door to the heart and the greatest door to the world that could ever possibly have come into my life, man. There is the fantasy end of music came true with me, and I'm not even like a, let's say I'm just a small yutz, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm an inside sort of guy, you know. I once got a chance to join Van Halen, and I said no, because they required and deserved to have somebody in the band that was more, let's say, of the philosophy and lifestyle and the manner that they were. So I didn't take the gig, because I didn't feel like it was the kind of environment I wished to be in. And had I taken gig, and a couple of other gigs like it, I'd probably be further, let's say, down the road. But I can't say anything except that I'm as thrilled and pleased with what has ever happened to me. And it's all due to music, man. Music is the greatest life-changing thing that has ever come, you know, down the pike. Look where you are, man. How'd you get this gig? How'd you get your...
Well, this came about... because of my world travels with music and my exposure to a lot of things that didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I started doing research, and I became a journalist. You know, one who's bringing out the truth of things that have been obscured from us.
Right.
The false history that we've been spoon-fed since we were born. And this is just an extension of music, in a way. It's you know, communication, and it deals with truth. So
truth is something, like I mentioned earlier, that it just is preferred, that people kind of prefer not to deal with it. And maybe because I've been to therapy, you know. And I'm not kidding, because I had been to therapy and recognized and learned that truth doesn't kill, merely hurts or it upsets.
Mm-hmm.
But it never kills, and it never deviates one toward, let's say, a bad path.
Yes.
There's nothing that can come from the truth except to guide one to live better and move into things that are more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all there is to it. But interestingly, I had a shrink who said nothing is really true, that what's true for me isn't true for you. And I had a problem with that, because the truth is, if I don't take vitamins or eat or something, I'll die soon. And the truth is that people do want to be happy. And the truth is that we're all looking for peace of some kind. And I recognize the differences, but there are truths. And most people, certainly in our industry, you know, truth is like an anathema. Don't even go you know, to don't ever try to mention the truth. So, I mean, our industry is built on fantasy, and that's okay. It is entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, the big industry, the acting industry. I mean, I've probably never seen more incapable actors these days than I do on TV these days, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the most pathetic. Who are these people? How did they possibly get into a situation where they can appear on television and call themselves entertainers or actors? And I recognize that maybe because the criteria is lowered, you know, the standards are lowered. If you lower the standards and nobody cares, you can speak garbage.
They're dumbing us down is what they're doing. And of course, you know, you can't get a Pacino or, you know, the like to do those kinds of scripts. They won't do them.
Right.
They certainly could sell them, but they're not going to make fools of themselves in that way.
No.
They do the hardcore stuff. Jeff, I want to play one more track here, if I can, while we have the moment, and give you a chance to reflect before we sort of sew this thing up.
Okay.
I'm going to play another track from your High Standards. And by the way, I would like to put a review of your album up on my website and some links to where people can get this. So if you can, after we listen to this, if you can have that information available, you're going to sell some CDs.
Oh, boy. Thank you.
All right. First, though, we're going to listen to I Want to Be Happy.
Thank you.
That is the We Are Happy version of I Want to Be Happy, featuring Jeff Berlin, Richard Drexler, and Danny Gottlieb. And Jeff, please thank those two gentlemen from me and from our listening audience for their contribution to the color and the inspiration of this show. Really, seriously. And also, I want to give a shout-out to your PR representative, Mr. William James, and thank him for writing the network, because that brought us back together again after 37 years.
Yes, sir. I'll do things. The guys are very important to me as friends and very important to me as musicians. So I got very lucky. We love to play and we love to hang. In fact, it's always fascinated us how much we kind of regard our hanging, you know, when we go and play, let's say on tours, like teenagers, you know, joyful at the fact that they're going off to summer camp. And that's our little analogy for it, because we really get goofy out there when we're in the van. And Billy James is a wonderful publicist. I quite accidentally, we had gotten in touch with each other, and I thought that High Standards by itself is never going to make an impact with people who are not into jazz. Billy has made it possible that a lot more than just jazz people seem to have paid attention to it and have gotten it and sort of found out about me, who didn't know about bass or me. Mm-hmm. And Billy has been very an ally, you know, and so I have a great debt to him. And he did come.
Himself, too, which helps, you know.
I didn't know he played. What does he play?
If I'm not mistaken, he's a drummer.
Oh.
He may punch me in the mouth and say, no, I said guitar. No, I thought he mentioned to me he played drums.
Okay.
So, you know, he's a player.
He's a player in his end of things. He's a true, a bona fide jazz musician in regards to what he does. He comes up with ideas and he's real clever and capable with it. You know, jazz to me is anything that's creative. Do you remember that story where there was a lady on a flight going to Europe, someplace in Europe, and this is a true story I'm about to tell you, and she and her lung collapsed. On the flight, she had something in her lung, just, you know, depressed. And a doctor who did not have his doctor kit on board took one of those masks that they're supposed to, you know, fall, come down from the roof, from the ceiling, you know, in case the pressure changes. Mm-hmm. And he got one and he got a tube from that mask and he took a coat hanger. And this is not a joke and it's not a phony story. And he punched a hole in the woman's chest and inserted this tube and somehow inflated this woman's lung and maybe saved her life. And I thought about that, that in my hands, that would have been murder weapons because I'm not qualified, nor do I have any knowledge or skill whatsoever to do something like that. Mm-hmm. In this guy's hands, as a medical man, he was a jazz doctor. He was a guy who took his skills and used them and invented a way to save a person's life. And that just sort of showed me, and when I heard that story years ago, it was again conferred upon me the fact that you can't do what you don't know. And that's one another validation for learning well, and you know, and it's just that's jazz.
And I wondered what happened to my coat hanger on that flight. Now I know the whole story now.
That's he was looking for you for 6 months, I heard, but he couldn't find you. So,
well, Jeff, we're about out of time, but I want to give out or have you give out any information, website addresses. Any important information so people can get a hold of your CD. And I'm going to see about getting the United Galactic Federation, who broadcast this show to over 2,000 planets, to see about getting a bulk order, because they're going to hear this music elsewhere, and your playing is out of this world. So,
well, you are beyond kind. Forgive me, I won't go long again, but I'm on the radio, so I'm taking advantage and talking. I've always taken it as my due that I was not going to get hurt, even to the minute that I did this record, in the fact that people aren't necessarily aware that there's good music out there. And so I accepted, and it was kind of ironically, you know, all right, there we go, I'll record this stuff, but nobody's really going to know. So any chance that I had an opportunity just to share the fact that there's good music, I mean, even if you don't like this, there's other things that are good to check out that are not necessarily on pop or radio, although that's valid too. There's lots of good stuff. So thank you for that, man. I humbly accept, and I guess if anyone wanted to hear my CD up close, you know, and personal, you would go to cdbaby.com, and it's there. I only chose one outlet to sell my CDs. The record companies really aren't interested in me because I play music, and frankly, music is not a requirement in music art and music recording sessions and art, pop art of these days. You know, people aren't really that into music, so I started my own little record company. Actually did pretty well with it. I'm selling pretty well as Jeff Berlin and selling CDs. But, yeah, man, I guess it's the long way around the barn, but I accept and I'd be thrilled. And if anyone wants to learn how to play, man, you should contact the Player School, because that's something very special. That's another thing.
Any info you want to give out in that regard?
Well, I guess the website is playerschool.com. And I think, that would probably be the best place to begin. We have a one-week intensive in March. The whole thing is to relate to a musician at their level, not my level, not what I expect from you, but what you are. And where you are is where we begin. So I want to teach guys music when I'm around. I want to teach guys music and make it valuable. I want people to come one way and leave changed.
Maybe
and that's what we do.
Maybe we could even incorporate that some of that event into the show, if you like. Maybe do a remote
I'd be thrilled.
Podcast.
I'd be thrilled. I'd be thrilled and honored. The idea of getting people into music and maybe hearing bass as a more of a unique instrument, I'm thrilled by it all, Don. So I'm truly very, very honored and flattered and can't thank you enough. You know, I was nervous tonight, to be honest, and probably talked way more than I should have, but I do that when I get nervous, you know.
Well, be nervous the next time you come on, because you had a lot to say. Okay.
Oi. Yeah, I want to come back. You're right. Now we're in touch again.
Yeah, we'll have you on again soon. I promise you. And maybe you can even get Richard and Danny to come along.
Absolutely. That's a promise. They're great. They're funny and smart. Richard's a crack-up. The king of puns. The king. In my house, Alice, I'm king. He's the king of puns, Richard Drexler.
All right. Well, Jeff Berlin, it has been an honor, and the honor and the pleasure is all ours. You're too humble.
No, sir. The honor and pleasure is all mine, and thank you for this rabbiting guy here. You know, I appreciate it, man. I was a lot of fun, and I hope people enjoyed. It's very nice of you to listen in, too, folks. So thank you so much. Very kind of you guys.
Okay, Jeff. We'll be in touch, I promise you. And, you know, you made my day and my night, and I'm going to be on this music high the rest of the week for sure. And I encourage the listeners to get a hold of your album. It's called High Standards, or I should say CD.
CD.
That's the lingo.
From the CD part of town.
That's right. And this show was heard all over the world, as I mentioned, and throughout the galaxy. So you did yourself real proud tonight, Jeff Berlin, and I look forward to your next appearance on Evident Footprints.
Anytime, Don. Let's be in touch, you and I'll talk to you tomorrow, in fact.
Okay. All right. You have a good one. And, folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to a special edition of Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. And world-renowned bass player and music instructor, Jeff Berlin. Check out his CD. You'll love yourself for it. And he's got more than one CD out there, too. So, well, hopefully I'll get my hands on some of that music for his next visit, and we'll explore some of his other work.
Oh, sure.
Special thanks go out to Wind Talkers Radio Network for carrying the show.
Thank you.
Also, are you still there, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm thanking Wind Talker.
Oh, okay. And over at BBS Radio, we want to thank Seth Hendrick on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow when my special guest will be former U.S. Marine Drew Malone Raines III. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and music, and have a good night.